This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, folks. Kevin Porter here. It's just me. And if you haven't been able to tell yet, this is not episode 108. Of the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel Quiz. We're not talking about the finale of season one. So here's what happened. Due to scheduling circumstances beyond our control, we were not able to get one in the can for release for this week, for Monday. We're trying all sorts of different like configurations and different ways of recording, but it just wasn't going to work. It wasn't going to happen. We try to get ahead of the curve as much as possible, but we... weren't able to on this one. So I thought, oh, we could put out like a little message saying, oh, we're taking this week off, JK, bye, or, you know, and just like not put anything out. But then I thought it might be a fun opportunity to do something a little bit different because we will be releasing 108 next week. But this week I thought it might be fun and interesting to delve a little more into the Jewish culture of the show. So we kind of had another chat with an expert, a woman named Jordana Silverman, who had written into the show before. We read a few of her emails on the show, and she really seemed to know what she was talking about with all this stuff. So I gave her a little call, and then we had a really nice chat. So you're about to hear that chat if you want to. We'll be back next week, but for now, enjoy this chat, this conversation about Judaism and the Jewish ethnicity and culture and religion with Jordana. Or Jordana. I pronounce her name both ways in the course of this conversation. Never quite getting it right like a typical musical that I am. But here it is, our conversation with Jordana Silverman.
You tell the whole darn world if you don't happen to like it.
So today on the podcast, we are joined, blessedly, if that's the right term, we are joined by Jordana Silverman, or Jordana Silverman. It's like Mazel Tov or Mazel Tov. You can go either way.
Both are correct.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us, Jordana. Really appreciate it.
Are you kidding? Thank you for asking me to talk to you. I am such a gilly. I've listened since you and Demi started.
Jordana, you sent us an email a couple weeks back talking about your experience and then your history and actually even your field of study as it pertained to Judaism and then its reflection on the show. It's something we read out loud on the show and we found to be just like really thoughtful and lovely. So I wanted to talk to you more about it and how Judaism functions on this show and in the lives of the characters in it, and Amy Sherman-Palladino's expression of it in the show. So real quick, could you just give me some background on like your upbringing with Jewish culture, ethnicity-wise, faith-wise, study-wise?
So I grew up in New Jersey in a commuter suburb to New York City in a neighborhood that's predominantly Orthodox Jewish with parents who were not Orthodox.
Okay.
So I was always kind of straddling two worlds. Orthodox Judaism is generally like your more right-wing type of Judaism, whereas my family kind of jumps around. I joke that I'm a chameleon when it comes to Judaism. I'm very comfortable in a very conservative Jewish setting, meaning whether it's an Orthodox setting where I need to be extremely modest and know certain like cultural behaviors and language and terminology, to the very liberal reconstructionist reform movement where, you know, I'm sitting here wearing jeans and I lived with my husband before we were married, which in some circles would be frowned upon. And at the end of the day, my dad came from a what I call conservadox family. So
conservative Judaism. This is fun. Yes. I've not heard this before.
So conservative Judaism is middle of the road Judaism.
Okay.
There's a whole big story, and I could turn this into a history lesson. So let me try to be not long-winded. Judaism was just Judaism for a long time. And then there was a Reformation in Germany in the middle of the 1800s that then trickled its way into New York with German Jewish immigrants. And they tried to blend being Jewish with secular Christian culture of America. So there's a story called the Great Dinner Disaster, where the first group of Reform rabbis get ordained and they serve this lavish meal that's full of food that isn't kosher. Half the rabbis go to storm out. Half of them are like, what? This is an amazing meal. And from there, conservative Judaism is born. Conservative Judaism is trying to conserve more of the traditions than the Reformation was at that point, but is still much more modern and much more liberal than what you think of when you hear like a conservative Christian.
Sure.
So it's a funny term, especially because it really only exists in America. The movement doesn't exist elsewhere. And so that's the type of synagogue my parents raised me going to predominantly, because it meant they could send me to public school and then send me to traditional classes about faith and learning how to read and pray in Hebrew and our holidays and all of those things. And I got very into it. I was a youth group kid. I was a summer camp kid. It really was my whole life. Through that, met people who were slightly more observant. So my father's family attended a conservative synagogue, and they were more practicing than my mom's family, who, to me, are the Maisels, like, or the Weissmans.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of both. Like, my mom's family has Moshe and Shirley's cadence to how they speak about things. They came here from Eastern Europe and were very religious, because religion wasn't religion. It was just, you're Jews, this is what you do.
Yeah.
They spoke Yiddish. They lived in Jewish, you know, enclaves of wherever they were, whether it was when they were in Chicago or Brooklyn or Newark, New Jersey. They always lived in these little enclaves. And to this day, I know how to put on the accent.
Mm-hmm.
And when I speak to one of my uncles, I apparently start talking like this, and I sound like a totally different person.
Yeah. It's like how I go back to Texas, I adapt some of a Southern accent when I'm back at home.
It's so funny. I can walk in the door and my husband will go, oh, so you're on the phone with your uncle. And I'm like, oh, okay. So I was even telling him about the fact that I was having this conversation tonight, telling him that I was going to talk about Yiddishkeit, Yiddish being the language that Eastern European Jews spoke.
Mm-hmm.
And then Yiddishkeit sort of being like the terminology for the idea of like Jewishness that kind of came from that. And he's like, it's not about God. It's about food, because every culture ultimately starts with, they think they're about food.
Hey, but breaking
that's
bread.
Universal.
Yeah.
Family, which then comes back to this idea of like holidays and obligation. And he goes, and don't forget education. I was like, you got it. I will make sure to note that.
Yeah.
So
all those things being a part of the experience.
So kind of blending all of that. I also grew up in a relatively urban area. So like I said, there was a very Orthodox neighborhood where I grew up. The rest of the area was very diverse. So I was one of the only, there was a handful of us, Jewish students in my school. The predominant population was either Latin American immigrants or Haitian American, African Americans. And so a lot of times growing up, people would ask me, you know, why don't you speak your language?
Yeah.
Or why don't you go to that Jewish school if you're Jewish? And it really made me even more curious. So that's one piece of my high school experience, is these questions day to day at public school versus being a part of this youth group. And when I got to college, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. But so I just kept taking classes that sounded interesting to me. And I ended up becoming a Jewish studies major Rutgers.
And what motivated that?
The number of credits that I had when I needed to declare a major. I was a really decisive 19-year-old. I had taken a ton of Jewish history, and I studied abroad in Israel in a town called Beersheba.
Okay.
So most people go to Tel Aviv, which is very Miami-like, or they go to Jerusalem, and they have this very religious experience. I went
Tel Aviv is like Miami?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Now, this comparison I've never heard as a goy.
Okay. So Tel Aviv gets compared to Miami because it's this really fun, really liberal beach town. It's the center of, like, gay pride in Israel. It's got tons of nightclubs and, like, the best shopping and nightlife in Israel. And then, no. I don't pick to go to any of these fun places. I went to a small town in the middle of the desert where very few people outside of the university experience actually spoke English.
Yeah.
And it was amazingly challenging. It was probably the hardest 6 months of my life. And I am so grateful that I did it. Through doing all of that, I realized I loved marketing, and I've actually been in the advertising world in New York City for the last few years. But my bachelor's degree really kind of just was me taking all of the classes that sounded interesting.
Yeah.
And never really thinking about a career, and then being one of those lucky ones who graduated in 2009, right after everything kind of got crazy with our economy here in the States. And so it's been a windy road to figure out where that put me as a professional, but I like to joke that therefore I've been a professional Jew.
So for you, with all those bona fides and all those credentials, when you watched The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, the first season of it, in its overall reflection of the culture, and you touched upon it a little bit, how it kind of reminded you of members of your family. But overall, in the macro sense of the show and the Palladino's expression of Judaism in this time in the 50s, how did you connect with that?
So, like I said, it obviously related pretty closely to some of my family, but I do have to say that, like, Judaism is full of people from so many different countries that it's so zoomed in on what gets called Ashki normativity. So Ashkenaz Judaism are those of us who come from Eastern Europe. They're mm-hmm. people whose families most likely spoke Yiddish, and we are the largest contingent of Jews in the United States. But we're not the only kind of Jews in the United States. There's a large Iranian or Persian Jewish community, mm-hmm. particularly in parts of Long Island and Los Angeles.
And are there these different kinds of Jewish people? Is this kind of comparative to, like, how in Christianity there's, like, Catholics and there's Baptists and Methodists and things like that? Is that kind of analogous, or does it function a little bit differently?
It functions a little bit differently because at the end of the day, we generally go back to the same texts, the same holidays, and very similar sort of belief system when you start to look at it from a religious perspective. Where it deviates is if you were to take a number of people from different regions of, like, Catholic parishes. And so why would one Catholic parish particularly, you know, feel strongly about one item, and then another Catholic parish might feel stronger about hunger versus, you know, abortion access or lack thereof, mm-hmm. or wanting to make better pro-life laws? Why is that the focus of that region? So what happens is that the food is slightly different because of regional differences, and some of the family customs are different. So this family to me represents a very common stereotype of New York, Yiddish-speaking, Eastern European Jewry that has achieved a certain level of success that, in my humble opinion, always ignores the fact that it stepped on the civil rights movement to even achieve it. Jews weren't considered white people when we first came to the United States. Mm-hmm. And it's one of my biggest pet peeves when other Jewish Americans who now walk through the world as a part of this, like, privilege, because really, if we change our names and changed our jewelry, you might not know, forget that we were allowed to be white people when Irish Catholics and Italian Catholics were added to who was considered white to try to reinforce Jim Crow America.
Yeah.
And so that upward mobility that we see in the Maisel family is, and the Weissman family is very reflective of that, but it's reflective of it because of things like affirmative action for people who were elevated to a more white status at that time. And that social commentary is just lacking because it's Amy Sherman Palladino's world, and that was never going to happen.
She lacked social commentary, you think?
I don't know. I mean, I'll have to watch Gilmore Girls for like the 30th time through to just
check it out. Yeah, check it out. You know, and that's something, and I'm glad you kind of hit upon that point, because I think that's something that even Alice and I have kind of misspoke or maybe misrepresented on the show in equating like, oh, you know, we're just three white people in the room, even if we have like a Jewish guest or something, and kind of equating like, oh, it's just the same, and kind of flattening that out, rather than kind of acknowledging that there is a difference in ethnic identity. And because for a long time, you know, Jews were persecuted not dissimilarly to non-white people or people of color.
And unfortunately, when we say for a long time, just you have to go back to what, Charlottesville, Virginia this summer.
Yeah.
When people were chanting, Jews will not replace us. And so much of the conversation around Charlottesville rightly talked about civil rights movement in America with people of color. It talked about Civil War monuments that should not be monuments. But at the end of the day, these same people hate me as much as they hate the person who they identify within 30 seconds of being someone they dislike. They just have to do a little more digging to figure out that I'm one of the people that they think of as subhuman.
Yeah.
And it's a really tough spot to stand in. And I know of some really wonderful young advocates who are working on that. But how do we bridge that gap? Because it's tough. We're privileged at the same time that we're persecuted. And it's a very strange sort of feeling. And seeing that elevation in the way that it took place in the 50s even ignores things like when my grandparents moved during the huge Levittown movement and people were moving into the suburbs. The town they moved to, the realtor told my grandparents, you're Jews, you can't live in this part, this part, or this part of town. This is the neighborhood we're going to look at houses in. And that was in 1953.
Wow.
So these aren't things that are so foreign.
Yeah.
But they're more covert, and I believe it's the FBI's hate crime list. Most years, crimes against Jewish community centers, synagogues, places of worship, places that are related to being Jewish, still top the list in the United States as the most targeted. They're not heard about as much outside of the community. I think that that is because there's a PR issue of how do we talk about this rightfully when so many of us, due to that civil rights, Jim Crow era elevation, are also in such positions of privilege. And you see and hear Jewish people on TV, and we're almost overrepresented at times. That I remember one of the reviews you guys read, actually, when Maisel was being first piloted, was someone commenting that, oh, exactly what we need, another show about New York values, that coded language for Jewishness.
Oh, that's right. That was one of the Amazon, I think, user reviews. Yeah, it was super coded, much like the New York sensibility comment in the West Wing pilot about Toby and Josh Lyman. Yeah.
Yeah. So actually, I will say, because of you guys, I have my husband listening to West Wing Weekly.
Hey.
I told him that Rishi was amazing.
Yes.
He's a huge West Wing fan. And so he thanks you guys for the recommendation.
Oh, that's so lovely. Yeah. Rishi has a voice built for this medium.
He really does.
What's frustrating, though,
is he was always a great guest.
Yeah, but it's a little unfair because he also has a face built for any medium. He's just a very beautiful, handsome man. Anyway, I can't get on a rant about how handsome Rishi Hirway is again.
So I mean, we can digress if you want.
Yeah. So, with that in mind,
yeah. though, I mean, taking all of these factors between the Ashkenormativity and then Jim Crow America and all of these pieces, it builds this like bubble of like, I could talk about this for more than the amount of time we have allotted. I could talk about this for the length of a Gilmore Guys episode, probably.
About season seven, that's like 3.5 hours.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and then we can also discuss within there why being Team Jess is the right thing to be.
Well, okay. Well, I think we're running out of time right now. I mean, listen, we're all Team Jess post a year in the life. We're team and no one for Rory. But
that's true.
Well, I was going to ask what you see as like some of the...
This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Squarespace. Now, unlike anything I've ever talked about on the air, I actually stand by Squarespace. I actually do because I've used it for everything I've made. Literally, GilmoreGuysShow.com, the very website for this very podcast, was made using Squarespace. How beautiful is that? KevinTPorter.com, I made that using Squarespace. My old bake shop website, that was made using Squarespace. Because you can do it all with Squarespace. You can sell content on your website. So exclusive stuff behind a paywall. You can sell memberships, courses, or sell files your customers can download like PDFs, music, or eBooks. You can do that with Squarespace. You can do analytics with Squarespace. So you can figure out who's visiting your website and why. And figure out how to get traffic and where's it coming from. You can also have people do flexible payments on Squarespace. Make checkout seamless for your customers with simple but powerful payment tools. Accepts credit cards, PayPal, Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. How nice is that? You can also do email campaigns, so there's constant outreach for your stuff and people know where to find you. So I'm going to let you know where to find Squarespace. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/GilmoreGuys to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. That's squarespace.com/GilmoreGuys. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now let's talk about your social battery. Maybe right now it's bursting at the seams with energy. Maybe it's a little drained. Maybe you're one of those people like my friend with their phone battery that keeps it 2% all the time, even when they stay home all day. And they definitely could charge up if they wanted to, but they don't. Well, regardless of where it is, it's important to understand why it is the way it is. Why is the battery low when it gets low? Is it because you're feeling less social? Is it because you're feeling sad? Is it because of emotions you've yet to identify? Or maybe just boundaries you haven't set for yourself yet? Either way, it can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves too thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. What's the right amount of socializing for you? How do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, maybe you don't. Maybe you need a little more alone time. Well, either way, therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. This is so important because I've been in therapy for 10 plus years, for some would say technically 11 years this month. And it's helped me so much understand where I get my energy from, how I use my energy, how to better use my energy, and how to maintain things in a way that's sustainable and healthy and good. And that's to do, of course, with boundaries, but also just understanding who I am and what I want. And I couldn't have done so much of that work without therapy. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/GilmoreGuys today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GilmoreGuys.
More positive aspects of the representation of Jewish culture in the show, because, you know, from an outsider's perspective, from the culture, it doesn't seem particularly, it seems a little more nuanced in its portrayal, or at least it gets a little more granular than something you would see, you know, just like in passing on a regular sitcom or even an hour long. It feels, you know, I feel like one of the only other shows I've seen delve this much into Judaism and things having to do with ethnicity and identity as well as religion would be something like another Amazon show, Transparent. So I'm wondering for you, like, what did you respond to as like some of the more positive aspects of how the show handled that stuff?
I think the nice thing for me is that Midge is so strong without being all of the terrible stereotypes of a Jewish mother, which is probably because, again, ASP ignored her children. So was she even really a mother? But right. That's an ASPism. So like, if you take the Palladinoism out of it, she isn't an overbearing Jewish mother, and she isn't just neurotic. She's confident and she is sassy in a way that I think a lot of, the Jenny Slates and a lot of Glazers of the world are, and Eliza Schlesinger's, and these amazing female Jewish comics who today are still doing the same thing that Joan Rivers paved the way for all of the amazing female comedians that you've spoken to have had the opportunity to do because of women like that. And because of women like Moms Mabley and Tattoo Dope Queens, like, we're able to see this just continuity of like strong womanhood in a way that I was just really excited by. And I think even within that, Rose, I'm hoping, gets like a serious arc next season. And Shirley is just like, Shirley's every negative stereotype. And when Moisha is like, I sent you guys a tweet at one point during all of this, when Moisha at the end of the bar mitzvah stuff is like, no, we were faking all these things and this is all just for appearances and he's not really your cousin. I said, this is what I always fear that David Duke thinks all of our fathers are. So to have Tony Shalhoub be the opposite of that, like, sure, you can still show that, but Tony Shalhoub is like amazing between his accent, his sing-songiness, and then just like the way he keeps his cool with the whole Bell Labs thing, and the way that Abe is just like so behind his daughter and appreciates her authenticity. I mean, that's way more my dad than Moisha ever is. And I think that showing that diversity of persona, because no group of people, no matter who you're talking about, no matter if it's a religion, an ethnicity, a shade of skin tone, is ever a monolith. Like, if you put five people who have one thing in common in a room, you still have five people. Yeah. And I think that ASP did a really good job with what she always does a good job with, which is creating an ensemble of crazy family members who are hilarious and interesting and has a strong and sassy female brunette lead.
For a change.
For a change, because she needed to switch things up a little bit.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, we only had Lorelai and, Sutton Foster and Bunheads. Like,
and Parker Posey. Let's never forget Parker Posey's contributions to the much beloved, canceled too soon show, with the return of Jezebel James.
I need to figure out where I can watch this, because I've listened to you guys talk about this for so long. I feel like I should have seen it by now.
I feel like I should have seen it by now. I'm still looking if there's any listeners out there that have bootleg copies or master copies, send them our way, GilmoreGuysShow@gmail.com. Now, and then just getting like a teeny tiny bit more granular, I feel like, and I feel like you've touched upon this in some communication you've sent our way, there are certain just kind of factual inconsistencies, it seems like, with some of the ways that the rituals and the holidays are portrayed in the show. So I was wondering if you could like speak a little more to that. Like, it seems like there's like some weird timeline issues with Yom Kippur, or even when they visit the synagogue, it seems to be, I think there was some question of the accuracy of that.
So my two timeline questions, and if somebody else is paying more attention, please feel free to tweet me. I'm in every single thread that the guys put out with questions. You'll find me. Okay, so in the opening, they're talking about Yom Kippur, and they're talking about having the rabbi over for breakfast. Now, Yom Kippur is the holiest day of the Jewish year. We abstain from food and drink for 25 hours as a sign that we are repenting for anything that we did wrong the previous year. And in something that I find to be one of the coolest parts about being Jewish, we all apologize for everything in unison. And nobody actually says, like, this is what I did wrong. We all apologize for everything that anyone could do wrong. And you're supposed to, like, obviously know within your heart and yourself, and if you wronged another person, to make amends with them. But I love that, to me, is so indicative of the core of Judaism, whether it's cultural or religious, is that everything is done in a communal way.
Yeah, that's lovely.
But breaking fast is like 100% by like every family, a bagels meal. It is dairy foods. It is fishes, which are not considered meat by kosher standards. And so it's bagels and lox and cream cheese and egg dishes. And she goes to the butcher to get lamb because it's the rabbi's favorite. And the other woman in line is getting pork chops.
Oh, yes.
Which would
this
mean that it's
pilot.
Not a kosher butcher.
Yes.
Right, which means that it's not a kosher butcher. And then, obviously, everything falls apart with Joel. She gets drunk. She goes down to the gaslight. She starts eating peanuts while sitting at the table with Susie and says, I shouldn't be eating. It's Yom Kippur. Which means that the meal they were having was breakfast and not the meal that they were having was the meal the night before. If it was the meal the night before, people have meat, they have something hearty because they're not eating for the next day. But the next night, you eat light because you haven't been eating for a while. So that's one timeline inconsistency that I personally chalked up to ASP doesn't seem like someone who grew up particularly religious. And I know plenty of people whose families don't observe the fast, but they insist that everyone get together for dinner. And so she picked something that sounded funny. A butcher shop in the 50s is an amazing set. And I chalked it up to that.
Okay.
And then when Rose loses it in synagogue.
Oh, yeah. This is in episode seven. Yeah.
In the last episode that we discussed, or you guys discussed on the podcast.
That we all discussed together as a podcast community.
That's right. So in that episode, I was trying to figure out what day of the week it is. So if it's Friday evening, then it makes perfect sense. The main song that they're sort of singing as this breakdown and fight happens is called Lecha Dodi. And it's one of the prayers that's said at the beginning of the Sabbath. The whole point of it is that you are greeting the Sabbath bride. And in most communities, that means that similar to a wedding, the congregation rises for it or partway through it. So it may just be that they didn't get to that part of the song because of the Weissmans creating a scene.
Right.
But you rise and face the door. And so my tweet to you guys was like, what kind of wedding is this where you don't look at the bride? Because the Sabbath bride is supposed to be entering and bringing in her beauty and grace to Shabbat, which begins Friday at sundown and ends Saturday at sundown. And then the song they were singing right before it, I was like, oh, maybe I'm rusty and this should be my sign that I feel guilty that I haven't been to synagogue on a Friday night in a long time, because that doesn't sound like the right progression of songs. And maybe it's just because they're both really beautiful songs and they both have really beautiful meanings. And the person who they hired to sing them, that was what he could do. And that's all fine. But I was just like, did she go meet with
freaking Sophie Lennon?
Thank you. With Sophie on a Friday afternoon and then go meet her parents right at synagogue? Or, you know, like, that's where I was getting a little lost. And I was like, I'm assuming that's what they're supposed to be saying, but it just didn't quite line up so well. And that also is just, and I think that's just another Palladinoism where time is a little fuzzy, in the same way that we're talking about how long has Midge been honing her craft.
Exactly, yeah. Where it, yeah, it just, it seems like more of a time inconsistency than maybe a religious inconsistency. Or, but in this sense, unlike other senses where it's like, did all this happen on a Tuesday? You know, like in Stars Hollow, this is actually, oh, if you get timeline stuff wrong, then you're actually getting, you know, religious stuff wrong because it's so tied to like time and day and things of that nature. So that's the first,
exactly.
That's the first time we've seen that function like that on one of their shows. So to be clear, are you going to be available as a religion consultant on season two of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel?
I would be honored and will continue to fangirl and harass everyone who knows me in real life with the fact that this is happening. Can I do a small plug, not for myself, but for a friend?
Sure.
Okay, so my friend Miriam, who wants everyone to know that she hates the fact that Miriam is now going to be associated with the nickname Midge, wrote an amazing article that really speaks, I think, better than I could have in the last 30 minutes on this idea of Jewish characters on television, what these stereotypes are for Jewish Boston. I'm going to send the link to you, Kevin, and if you could put this with the show notes.
Lovely. Yeah, we'll put in the show notes.
I think that this is just like, it really encapsulates this idea of like, you know, what is Ashkenaz normativity and what are these stereotypes that we see from Larry David type shows and how much more there is to what it means. But I would be honored to answer anything, and I'll continue to be a total troll to everyone in the tweets. I love talking to all of you. I love getting to be a Gilly. It's been such an amazing thing. So in the time that Gilmore Guys has been part of the podcast universe, I had moved from Boston back to New York, started commuting. I don't technically live in New York. I only work in New York. I live in New Jersey. And so with that long commute comes many hours on New Jersey Transit, who is notoriously unreliable. And your podcast, in addition to many of your friends who you've brought on who talk about TV shows that I love, has become my me time and my way of really enjoying this commute, which isn't always enjoyable. And so I appreciate that all of my tweets out into the ether have turned into something, and that there's this awesome community of people who love great TV to interact with when I'm stuck riding the train for way too long every day.
Oh, well, that's really, really lovely. I really appreciate that. Thanks so much for saying that.
Yeah.
So, you know, before we go and before we let you go, on the subject of good TV, you know, and talking about different representations on different shows, and I'm sure something that your friend's article gets into, what do you see as a really positive, really well done representation of Jewish ethnicity, Jewish culture in a TV show or movie or something you've seen recently? This can be your pop culture plug, as it were.
Ooh. You know, I'm not sure. I think, unfortunately, Maisel might be it for me at the moment.
Oh, wow.
with what represents being Jewish really well. But I'm sure in like 20 minutes, something else is going to come to me and I'm going to be like, oh, I should have said that.
Yeah.
The other thing is, to be fair, I'm 7 months pregnant, work a crazy job, and really don't get to watch as much TV as I'm really hearing I'm going to get to in about 2.5 months. So maybe I'll circle back with you in between diaper changes.
Sure.
And at that point, I will probably have even more TV on my list of things that I've watched through and through to speak to.
Yeah, and anyone who wants to watch a lot of TV, we want to really encourage you to go out, get pregnant, and, you know, just kick back and relax and put on the
Netflix.
I mean,
I hear it's going to be so great. Like everyone says, it's just going to be like, I hear I'm getting like 3.5 months off from work, and it's just going to be super relaxing. So,
well, Jordana, whatever your flavor preference may be, thank you so much for talking with me. I really appreciate the conversation. Where can people find you on Twitter and on social media?
Sure. So I am JMO, because my middle and maiden name, Silverman, on Twitter. And you will find me trolling the comments of the Maisel Goys.
It's not trolling if it's positive. There's probably a word for like positive trolling where you're doing what a troll would do, but in the positive sense. That's what you're doing in our comments.
Oh yeah, no, I love pumping up everyone else in this community. People say so many smart things that I'm like, oh my God, yes, that. And yeah. I would have totally thought of that if I was spending 5 more minutes on it. And you guys, the community that you have been able to build around you, between both the people in your real life that you've brought in from UCB and the amount that I'm like in awe of all of that, and then the community that now follows, to the group of Gillies who traveled all over America and tweeted about it, and we saw that were helping you in every way they could when you and Demi were doing things for Gilmore Guys. Like, it's just amazing the way that social media has the ability to bring people together and tear us all apart simultaneously. And so, I mean, I will be there to cheer on all of you, especially when you have your Milo Ventimiglia gifs or gifts.
Bring on the Milo gifs. Get us crockpot gift, baby. Well, I really appreciate the kind words. That's so, so sweet. So thanks again for joining us on this special segment and this special episode. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. This is amazing.
That was great. Here's what I'm finding is like, man, so many of our listeners are just articulate as heck. Articulate as heck, know what they're talking about, smarter than me, and I'm really like blown away and honored to be a part of this community. So again, hopefully you enjoyed the combo, and we'll be back next week for the finale of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.